Practically from the inception of the game, baseball and America have been, in a symbolic sense, virtually synonymous. Thus begins Mitchell Nathanson's new book, A People's History of Baseball. Mr. Nathanson, a professor of legal writing at Villanova University School of Law, joins me from Philadelphia. Welcome to Only a Game.
Hi.
You explain how the meanings and even the definitions of both baseball and America have been manipulated to serve such constituencies as the wealthy men who have owned Major League Baseball teams. Can you give me some examples?
Well, initially, baseball was considered America's game before it was America's game. And that was propagated by people who wanted to be seen as the elites. They weren't the elites. These were people who had some money, but were generally left out of the upper-class clubs. We're talking in the mid to late 19th century at this point. Mm-hmm. And in the upper-crust world, participation in cricket clubs was the place where you would normally go. They were kept out of those, so they started baseball clubs and presented that to the public as America's game.
You say that the allegedly American tendency to root for an underdog, the Cubs, for example, tends to free fans up to ignore society's genuine underdogs. Explain how that works.
Well, we look at ourselves as Americans as being unique in that we root for the underdogs. And in fact, it's more a propensity of human nature than it is of being an American. The thing that makes Americans different is not that we root for the underdog. It's that when we see an underdog, we see someone who may be not the favorite, but who in our mind's eye will eventually win anyway. And what that does is it kind of blinds us to the reality of the fact that there are certain individuals and certain teams and certain groups that seem to always win.
And this makes it less likely that we'll root for any kind of real change that would help genuine underdogs outside the world of baseball, I gather.
Right. Well, we do have in this country a history of placing our faith in sort of these Horatio Alger tales, the lovable rube who overcomes great adversity and wins ultimately. So we tend to put our faith in that, and we tend to look at that one example out of 100 where somebody did overcome, rather than looking at the 99 times out of 100 when that person didn't overcome. If you looked at the 99, you'd say to yourself, well, there seems to be something wrong here. Why don't we try to fix it?
You mentioned that in 1994, Newt Gingrich, then the driving force behind the Republican Party's contract with America, said the dispute between Major League Baseball's owners and the players would vanish in an instant if both sides sat down together and watched Field of Dreams. And you maintain that this statement was, I'm quoting now, consistent with Gingrich's prescriptions for many of society's ills. Was Mr. Gingrich alone in that point of view, or was it representative?
It was representative of a lot of people and a lot of thinking at the time. Field of Dreams is a great movie, but it has no basis in reality, and it has certainly no connection to the reality of the labor dispute that was taking place at the time. What I was talking about in terms of Newt Gingrich was he is very much a modern incarnation of this positive thinking ethos, which has been with us in American culture since the mid to late 19th century, where we tend to look at the positive, we ignore any inconvenient facts, any inconvenient realities that seem to contradict those. That's what he was talking about. He was saying, well, let's forget the labor issues. Let's all sit down. We'll watch the movie. We're going to see how wonderful baseball is, how transformative baseball is, and everyone will get together and be fine. Well, that doesn't resolve the labor issues. It doesn't resolve the problems that caused the strike in the first place.
You suggest that those who've challenged the myths and the assumptions of the baseball establishment suffer abuse for a while, and then they get assumed into the very establishment they've criticized, or at least that seems to me to be what you've said about Bill James.
Yeah, Bill James is interesting in that he, nowadays, everybody looks at Bill James as really spouting the gospel. But for many years, he was an outsider. He wasn't really tied to a particular team. His team, the Kansas City Athletics, had moved when he was a kid. So there were no teams for him to root for when he was a kid. He just chose the game itself. He started looking at baseball differently. And what happened was he started publishing his baseball abstracts in the mid-1970s. And he presented a lot of different ways of looking at the game, and he was ridiculed by those within baseball. He was seen as a guy with a slide rule and no real athletic ability, and therefore he wasn't qualified to comment on the game. But what he was doing was showing people a different way of looking at it, and in many ways, a more accurate way of looking at it. Eventually, he was proven right over and over again, and the Boston Red Sox eventually hired him, and they've won two World Series ever since.
As you acknowledge in A People's History of Baseball, the National Football League has become much more popular than MLB, no matter how one measures that popularity. What, if anything, does that say about the contemporary U.S. audience?
Well, it's different, and it's different in how we watch the game. I think that what the NFL has shown is that it's more important to be good on television than it is to be good in person. And I think the thing that baseball had going for it for many years was that it was good when you were there. It was a terrible product on television. Just because of the way the game is laid out, the NFL is just much more naturally attuned to that sort of an audience. And I think that's where baseball suffered. You know, the football field looks like a television screen. I mean, it's laid out that way. And all of the action takes place with usually within a five-yard burst, whereas baseball, the action doesn't take place just solely between the pitcher and the catcher and the batter. There's the things going on in the outfield. There's the moving of the runners around and things like that. You don't catch that, or you historically did not catch that on television. Although if you look at television, baseball on television now, particularly in the postseason, you do see those things. And that's why I think baseball's caught up to football.
Mitchell Nathanson, who teaches legal writing at Villanova University School of Law, is the author of A People's History of Baseball, published by the University of Illinois Press, and the author joined me from Philadelphia. Mitchell, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. It was great. It was a lot of fun.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages like pizza from Italy and cheddar from Australia. Locations at TraderJoe's.com. This is NPR.